he's very much in kind of like fur-lined handcuffs at the RNC right now.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. This is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they are shaping the political landscape. Returning to the roundup this week is the inimitable Lucy Caldwell. Lucy is a veteran political strategist and tech founder. She's a board advisor at the Renew Democracy Initiative and a former senior political advisor at the Goldwater Institute. Lucy, welcome back as always. Great to see you.
So good to be with you.
Making his Politicology debut is Greg Bluestein. Greg is a political reporter and author who covers the governor's office for politics for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He co-hosts the Politically Georgia podcast and is an MSNBC and NBC News contributor. He's also the author of Flipped, a book about Georgia's 2020 election. Greg, it's great to have you here. Welcome to Politicology.
Guys, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Up first this week, we are going to look at the Republican primary in Georgia, Nikki Haley peeling off more than 10% of the vote after dropping out of the race. Then we'll discuss No Label's decision to move forward with their push to draft a third-party presidential candidate and the report that it could be someone from Georgia. After that, we'll look at Donald Trump's takeover of the Republican National Committee, the new leadership's purge of staff, and what it could mean in this election cycle and beyond. Then we'll find out what other political developments our panel are paying attention to and why. Finally, for our Politicology Plus members, we're going to discuss Congress's latest push to ban TikTok, why Donald Trump is now flip-flopping on banning the app, and why you should care about all the data it's collecting and who they could give it to. If you're not yet one of our amazing Politicology Plus members and you want to hear more from our brilliant guests, politicology.com/plus is how you can get access to everything we publish, and it's all free. And you'll be joining a thoughtful group of pro-democracy listeners who help keep this show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus or click the link in your show notes today. Okay, so Tuesday night, both Biden and Trump locked enough delegates finally to become their party's presumptive nominees with wins in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State. Nikki Haley, who was the most successful challenger to Trump, dropped out of the race last week, but she pulled in more than 77,000 votes in the Georgia primary. There are still an estimated 18,000 votes left to count, but she's sitting at about 13% of the Republican primary vote. And as a reminder, Biden's margin of victory in Georgia in 2020 was 11,779 votes. Haley won nearly 40% of primary votes in DeKalb County and 38% in Fulton County. And my ride or die here at Politicology, Mike Madrid, tweeted, "This is big. Trump's problems in the suburbs continue in Georgia." Haley also pulled in 22% of the vote in Washington State, but those contests allowed Democrats and independents to participate in the primary. So at 238 days, this is now officially, technically, the longest general election campaign in U.S. history. 2000 and 2004 were both just a day shorter. So we have two universally known candidates. Mentally and emotionally, let's just start there. How are you both feeling about this very, very long general election ahead, Greg?
Well, people always ask me when it's going to start to heat up. Well, it has already heated up, even though we have 8 months slog ahead. I mean, look, just in Georgia, a couple of days ago, we had simultaneous visits by former President Trump and President Biden. For us down here, it was a sign that, hey, our state's going to be in the middle of everything. But really, it kicked off a general election campaign. It's going to be nasty. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be exhausting. And a lot of voters, your listeners aren't among them, but a lot of voters won't be even tuning in until October.
That's right. Lucy, how does this feel to you? In campaign world, it sort of feels like we've been going since 2020. But technically, we are now off to the races with two presumptive candidates.
I'm psyched. I am psyched that we're off to the races at this time. And I'll tell you why. The reason is that the fact that even though it was a foregone conclusion that this was going to be another Trump-Biden matchup, but people hadn't really faced up to that. People hadn't really tuned in, especially tuned into Donald Trump. And I think it was really depressing Biden's performance in the polls. And I think we're about to see that turn. And the reason is that people have forgotten just how wacko and nuts and damaging and authoritarian Donald Trump is, because he hasn't been at our, like on our screens, like in our front view, right? And so we were able to do this kind of get lulled into this fantasy land in the Republican primary, like that Nikki Haley was going to have a moment, or she was going to rally. Or, I mean, remember when we thought that Tim Scott was a person we should take seriously? And that was bad because that allowed us to not face up to the fact that we are going to once again in 2024 be in a fight for the future of our country and that American democracy really, really hangs in the balance. Now that we are in a Biden-Trump matchup, now that we are viewing, for example, Biden's State of the Union in the context of a Biden-Trump matchup, we can really get serious about this again. And I think we can get serious about it across a lot of different verticals, right? One would be the grassroots vertical, right? Like, let's dispense with the stuff about how, you know, like we're going to sit out the election because Biden is like not... is screwing things up in the Israel-Hamas conflict, right? That's ridiculous. You're going to go cast your ballot for Donald Trump? I don't think so. In the donor vertical, right? Like, let's get serious about the fact that we need to do everything we can to help Joe Biden be reelected. It is going to be a Biden-Trump matchup. No Labels does not have a path. Like, let's not do the kind of like self-fulfilling prophecy stuff that we've been doing where we act like this is a disaster. So I think on the whole, it is awesome that we now know in mid-March of 2024 that it is going to be Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. It gives everyone who cares about this and cares about being serious about what's at stake here a chance to really get in the game. I'm psyched.
And some closure over all of the hand-wringing and bedwetting on the Democratic side, for sure. So, Greg, I want to dig into the numbers in Georgia for a very specific and important reason. We've been talking on the show a lot about the usefulness of Nikki Haley, which is her performance among Republican voters, and how many of those people who voted for Nikki Haley would ultimately be not Trump voters, right? They're not Trump voters in the primary. What percentage of them are going to end up being not Trump voters in the general? And the two states I've been looking for have been Georgia and Arizona. We got a lot of interesting insights from Super Tuesday, but Georgia and Arizona in particular, Arizona was coming up next week. What can you tell us about the numbers in Georgia, Haley getting 77,000 votes, even though she dropped out of the race last week? What percentage of those votes did she get early, potentially before dropping out, and what it looked like for her on election day?
Yeah, and they weren't all pure protest votes, or else you could, although you could argue that by the time early voting started in Georgia, the race was effectively over. But, you know, she still was in the campaign for at least about 2.5 of those 3 weeks of early voting that Georgia had, in which she amassed more than 50,000 votes. But it's much easier to point to the 20,000 votes that she collected on Tuesday, primary day, 6 days after she dropped out of the campaign. Those were pure protest votes. Now, Georgia has an open primary, meaning that anyone can vote in it. So, you know, theoretically, some Democrats could have crossed over and voted just to make their displeasure for Donald Trump known. But plenty of Republicans voted too. And I talked to plenty of them who said that they voted because they still are very uncertain. They're very uncomfortable with Donald Trump, the idea of him. One of those potential Nikki Haley voters might just be Governor Brian Kemp, who wouldn't tell me who he voted for last Friday when he cast an early ballot, but has said he's reluctantly supporting, I'm using the word reluctantly, not him, but he seems reluctant in his support for Donald Trump. And he's just emblematic of that crossover, that key constituency in Georgia. I'm not calling him a crossover voter, but there was this group of Kemp Warnock voters back in 2022 who split their ticket in a state like Georgia, where people usually just vote down party lines. They decided the election in 2022, electing both Governor Kemp and Senator Raphael Warnock, a Democrat. They decided the election back in 2020 and 2021 when President Biden became the first Democrat to carry Georgia since 1992, and that Ossoff and Warnock flipped Georgia Senate races and those upset victories. And I think that block of voters that Kemp is kind of in the middle of is going to be emblematic and symbolic in this election too.
So what we do know then is that she, after dropping out of the race, she did exceed, well, nearly doubled Biden's 11,000 vote margin in 2020. But what we don't know is how many of those election day voters were actually Democrats. Fair?
Exactly. Or independents or swing, you know, all that. Yes. So we don't know how many of those would be traditional Republican voters, but there's still that mainstream Republican kind of avenue. And one of Nikki Haley's top supporters in Georgia. Her co-chairman of her finance committee is a guy named Eric Tenenblatt, a Republican strategist who we talk to on our Politically Georgia podcast all the time, who's among those who's still not ready to endorse Donald Trump. You know, and he doesn't think he might never, right? And he's not alone. So there is that block of voters. It could just be, you know, a couple percentage points in a state like Georgia, but that could prove decisive in a state like Georgia that, as you guys have mentioned, flipped by fewer than 12,000 votes in 2020.
So Georgia's obviously going to play a big role this election cycle. I think most of our listeners understand why. It was critical to Biden's 2020 win. It was one of the states where Trump tried to change the outcome of that election. There's the Fulton County case. We should know this week whether DA Fannie Willis and her office will be conflicted out. Greg, can you just sort of summarize what outsiders should be watching for in the state right now?
Yeah, and the biggest decision, the biggest part of this case is about to come up, and we're expecting any moment a decision from Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee on whether Fannie Willis and her office should be disqualified from pursuing this case, from overseeing this election interference case on the grounds of a conflict of interest when she hired Nathan Wade, a special prosecutor who she has acknowledged she had a personal relationship. And the question is whether or not she financially benefited from that and how forthcoming, how truthful she was in disclosing that relationship. Nothing to do with the election interference indictments, nothing to do with the underlying case, but still a whole mess of problems for Fannie Willis. And if she's disqualified, we have compared it to the AJC to basically a death sentence for this trial. And that's because under state law, it would throw the decision about whether to prosecute to a nonpartisan agency, state agency called the Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia, which is not active aggressively on another part of a much smaller part of this case. And there are very few prosecutors, not just in Georgia, but probably across the country, that would be eager to take on this case. And I keep on going back to the testimony of former Democratic Governor Roy Barnes, one of the most renowned trial lawyers down here in Georgia, who said, "I don't want to take that case. You know, I've lived with armed guards for 4 years already. I don't want to live with it more." Because you think about all the death threats, the personal threats to safety, the racist invective, everything that Fannie Willis has had to deal with. You know, very few prosecutors are willing to go through what she's gone through.
I want to move to No Labels because there's a lot to get to here. Last week, No Labels announced that they're moving forward with their plans to draft an independent presidential ticket. So the Wall Street Journal is reporting that they're considering Jeff Duncan, that's G-E-O-F-F, to lead the unity ticket. If you're racking your brain for exactly who Jeff Duncan is, he's the Republican former lieutenant governor of Georgia. More high-profile politicians like Nikki Haley, Larry Hogan, Joe Manchin have ruled out running for president on a No Labels ticket. And after Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona announced she wouldn't seek re-election this year, No Labels tweeted that Sinema has made clear that her time in electoral politics is over, so she won't be running. The Journal also reported that No Labels had approached Georgia Governor Brian Kemp to gauge his interest, but he declined. Duncan was one of the first elected leaders in the Republican Party to publicly reject the claims that the 2020 election had been rigged. Duncan also defended Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger when Trump's allies were calling for his resignation. He also publicly condemned the January 6th riot at the Capitol. And in 2021, Duncan announced that he wouldn't be running for re-election as lieutenant governor. He did write a book in 2021, GOP 2.0, How the 2020 Election Can Lead to a Better Way Forward for America's Conservative Party. He advocated for Republicans to focus on conservative policies, not charismatic leaders, like Trump. Duncan isn't the first or only Republican who says the party's moving down the wrong path. In 2020, we fielded probably thousands of questions from Lincoln Project supporters asking if we were going to build a new conservative party. Liz Cheney has talked about rebuilding the Republican Party or building a new conservative party, but she's been very consistent in saying that work obviously needs to come after the 2020 election. We've got a clip of her on ABC. Do you want to roll that?
You know, there's a lot that has to be done to begin to rebuild the Republican Party, potentially to build a new conservative party. But in my view, that has to wait until after the 2024 election, because our focus has got to be on defeating Donald Trump.
So, Lucy, we've talked about this at length, at least No Labels at length. and how misguided, maybe to put it the most charitably, their push is. What do you make of this decision, not only to push forward, even as the more high profile and better funded options have all said no after looking at what it would mean, and their decision to name a guy like Jeff Duncan?
Oh, Jeff Duncan. This is kind of like, I guess, let me introduce some awful metaphors here. It's kind of like if you get an offer to become like homecoming king or homecoming queen, but it turns out that that's because all of the other people that everyone would rather have instead, like, you know, were suspended for bad grades, or, you know, they have mono, so they can't come to school for a few months, or, you know, some other thing. And, but then it gets worse because if you are in the no labels world, if you're going to be named homecoming king or homecoming queen, you also are about to find out that you're going to have to build your own float, and that there's no homecoming court. And also, by the way, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to turn on the lights in the stadium to have your homecoming parade, because No Labels is a completely unseaworthy vessel. That's why the big names have all said no. You know, at a glance, like, No Labels operating way outside the law, like, hasn't properly registered with the FEC, has failed to properly disclose spending on state campaign finance filings, is the subject of an IRS complaint, is the subject of an FEC complaint, doesn't have ballot access very many places, has ballot access in maybe 16 places. What does that mean? That means that they would be saddling a would-be candidate, in this case, Jeff Duncan, with a huge uphill battle for ballot access in more than 30 states. That's a spend of tens of millions of dollars between now and summer that none of the candidates that they've floated are in any position to fund and can't be raised via unlimited contribution. That would be raised in increments of $6,600 per donor, right? Jeff Duncan, lovely guy. I know about him because I'm a political operative who does a lot of work in ballot, in battleground states, but Jeff Duncan has no name ID, right? Like, how are we going to get Jeff Duncan's name ID up? Those are just some of the problems. So why is No Labels doing this? No Labels is doing this because they are so far down this rabbit hole that they don't know how to back out of it. They don't know how. I mean, by their own admission, they're now sort of saying privately that they know that they're not in it to win it, and that maybe this would result in just sort of a contingent election, which, by the way, I just want to, as a side note, remind people of how frightening that is. They'll say, like, oh, a contingent election, you throw it to Congress, but not this Congress, a new Congress. Just for everyone's edification, because we've never dealt with a contingent election before, I want to remind you, it's not 435 members of Congress casting a ballot for a president. It is every state delegation of Congress getting one vote en bloc to pick someone. That means that Harriet Hageman's vote in Wyoming, where they have one Republican congressperson, counts the same as the dozens and dozens of congresspeople in California, right? California gets one vote and Wyoming gets one vote. So all of this is to say, No Labels is doing this because they're so deep in the grift that they don't know how to back out of it. And they're going to keep this going for as long as they can. This week, they move forward with announcing their nominating committee. And they're going to say, you know, we're going to work in the next few weeks to figure this out. They're just going to run out the clock for as long as they can. Why is Jeff Duncan not putting this down in the same way that other people are putting it down? He's not, because suddenly we're talking about Jeff Duncan and now we suddenly know who Jeff Duncan is. And no one knew outside of Georgia who Jeff Duncan was before. No offense to Jeff Duncan, but Jeff Duncan is a person who is young, talented, could have a bright future ahead of him in exactly that work that you played the clip of Cheney talking about, rebuilding a movement, rebuilding a future party. And he is very comfortably ensconced right now in a cable news contract. Jeff Duncan, I think, when push comes to shove, is a savvy guy, and he's going to do what all of the people before him have done and ultimately say, yeah, this is not my bag. Wish them the best of luck. No Labels is such a sinking ship. They're having things go wrong right and left. In addition to all of the things we talked about before, Pat McCrory, who was their number one booster, who was one of their co-chairs, resigned this week, right? Like, they've had Joe Manchin step away. They've had Larry Hogan step away. Now they're having Pat McCrory step away. They are just not an entity that is built for prime time. And we're just going to have to wait a few more weeks until they realize that themselves, in my view.
Jeff Duncan realizes it, hopefully. Greg, you I'm sure, have a much better view of Duncan than most people in the country. He's not really a household name. First of all, tell us a little bit about sort of his role in Georgia politics. And what was your reaction to seeing his name floated out there? And do you think, you know, okay, this is, do you think he'll, you know, listen to reason and eventually back away from this? Or do you think the sort of the spotlight attracts him?
You know, he hasn't commented. We were able to confirm the Wall Street Journal report last week. He hasn't commented any since. I see him fairly regularly. He still hangs out downtown Atlanta sometimes. I saw his son at the state capitol. This is how cozy Georgia politics can be, right? I know his family, I know his wife. And he's been fascinating to cover over the years because he was a kind of a backbench state house member. And normally, the lieutenant governor is the president of the state senate. Normally, you know, the state lieutenant governor candidates come out of the senate, not the house. And he kind of ran this uphill battle against a very favored Republican leader who everyone thought was going to kind of be the heavy favorite. And he ends up winning by a narrow margin and then ousts and then defeats a Democratic candidate in 2018. It was unconventional. You know, he was not used to the reins of power, kind of entered office as a conventional Republican, but and was an ally of Donald Trump, you know, has all these pictures of him. He got to ride in the beast with Donald Trump when he visited Georgia one day during his presidency and tweeted about how exciting that was for him, right? You're more conventional Republican. But then as 2020 came and went, and there was incredible pressure on him, on Governor Kemp, on Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. We've all heard the phone call with Raffensperger, but that phone call was not an anomaly. You know, that's just out there because someone happened to record it and it leaked to us in the media. But there was incredible pressure being put on Duncan, on the late House Speaker David Ralston, on Governor Brian Kemp in phone calls and conversations from Trump and others that are the subject of, at the center of this indictment, the Fulton County election interference case. But Duncan went public and said, I am not going to call for a special session. I'm going to oppose a special session to invalidate Joe Biden's win. And became instantly a hero to some people, you know, some Democrats and some people in the middle, but an enemy to a lot of MAGA Republicans. So much so that when it came time for him to decide about running for a second term, knowing that he would, like Governor Kemp and others, be opposed by Trump-backed challengers, he decided not to run for a second term. The others did and ended up winning. Raffensperger wins. Brian Kemp wins. Our insurance commissioner, John King, wins. The attorney general, Chris Carr, wins. Duncan, though, went the other route and kind of went further than they did. Most of those four incumbents I just mentioned have, you know, haven't cozied up to Donald Trump, but also haven't bashed him every chance they get. Jeff Duncan has, whether it be on his CNN cable show when he's making appearances on CNN or in columns or in tweets or whatever. He has gone after Donald Trump in a far more aggressive way. And also Donald Trump's allies here in Georgia. And I think one of the most notable things he's done was he went to the ballot box in 2022, but did not vote for Herschel Walker. I don't think he voted for Raphael Warnock, the Democrat, either, but he made a big show of going to the ballot box and sort of in protest and not voting for the Republican candidate for Senate, Herschel Walker, who many other Republicans also didn't like, but was the Trump-backed candidate in Georgia. And then flash forward a couple more, a year or so, he was one of the key witnesses who testified in not just to the special grand jury that Fani Willis convened, but the grand jury that actually indicted Donald Trump. And while many kind of surreptitiously went behind the courthouse and testified, he was not shy about his testimony and conducted a fairly long interview with me right outside the courthouse. So not shy at all about opposing Donald Trump. Whether he ends up embracing this no labels candidacy, I think he's clear-eyed about whatever he ends up doing. I think he knows he's not going to win. But I think for him, it's more about promoting that GOP 2.0, whether it be the book, you know, that he wrote or that general ideology of, hey, Republicans have to move forward after Donald Trump. A lot of Republicans like him thought the party would already be moving on now. It clearly it isn't.
Yeah, we're going to get to how clearly it is not in the next segment when we talk about the RNC. But Lucy, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about this GOP 2.0 idea, not his idea per se, but the idea that maybe that trying to build a new conservative party or or build something from the ashes that once was the Republican Party is a noble effort or could be a noble idea. You and I have both spent time in the independent space, in the alternative party or new party reform space for a lot of the same reasons. Listening to Greg talk about Duncan's history, his profile, there's a lot to admire there. There's a lot to admire in the way he has shown courage to stand up to Trump, et cetera. What would you say to Jeff Duncan? Okay, imagine he's here. Imagine he's seriously considering getting involved with No Labels and their sort of election sabotage campaign here. What would it do to the idea of GOP 2.0 if Duncan gets involved with No Labels and the legacy of that effort is handing the election to Donald Trump? How much credibility does someone like that stand to lose if they get involved with No Labels and the outcome is exactly what we've been saying it would be?
At the most extreme end, I would say to him, there may never be a chance to rebuild the Republican Party if you do this, or the chance to build something new, because you will be handing the election to a person that we know may never peacefully leave office. And people like you, Jeff Duncan, and people like me, never Trump political operatives, are going to, may be targeted by Donald Trump. We have a lot of good reason to think that we will be. And that's really what's at stake here. That is truly what's at stake. And that's not hyperbole. I mean, people that are names familiar to Politicology listeners, whom you would have no reason to think would be targeted, are being named as targets of Donald Trump and his team. People like Tim Miller, who's now just a journalist, right? Who's a former Republican, who's a communications director for the RNC, right? And a Jeb Bush guy, and now is a journalist. Like, Tim is a person that the Trump team has talked about, you know, like, put him in camps, right? I mean, this is serious. These are really the words that they say. So it's fine and nice to talk about GOP 2.0, and I would be happy to be in that conversation, and I have been in those conversations, but now is not the time to do that. And I don't mean that now is not the time to build a new party. I actually also am very involved in efforts to build a new party and to build infrastructure for independent candidates and independent voters through several things, through entities like the Forward Party, which has said it will not participate in any of the work in fielding a candidate in 2024 because they're not insane. Efforts to push structural reforms to make politics more competitive so that new party candidates or independent candidates are not spoilers, and also building infrastructure. There's so much that goes into running for office. You know, you need a way to door knock, you need support to get vendors who will work with you, all of the stuff. I'm engaged in all of those things, but that work begins at the state and local level, not at the presidential level. There are just realities of the how our presidential elections happen that constitute reasons that you cannot just sort of like inject a new party, a new candidate, and expect to have a good outcome. And we know in 2024 that the 2024 presidential race, God willing, between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, though there are other factors that we have to deal with, like the Bobby Kennedy of it all. But we know that that race is going to be determined in a few states like Georgia, like Arizona, right, like Pennsylvania. And it is going to be determined by the people that we call double haters or double doubters. And those are the candidates, or excuse me, those are the voters that it is a constituency that you know very well, because that is a constituency that you spent a lot of 2020 activating around. And those people do not like either Trump or Biden. They ultimately in 2020 came home to Joe Biden, and we hope that they're going to come home again. But any kind of effort like Jeff Duncan getting engaged in this is going to put all of that in serious danger. And the other thing I would say to Jeff Duncan is, it's not like after you spoil the election in favor of Donald Trump, you are going to wind up in a situation where like the Republican Party embraces you. You will have just both delivered them a Donald Trump reelect on a platter, and you also will still be their enemy. So there is no upside. Now, I understand that there is short-term upside for all of these prospective candidates to be in the mix, because as a frequent collaborator of mine often says, for a lot of these people, it's MSNBC or mow the lawn, right? It's meet the press or mow the lawn, right? Like, you get to be in the conversation if you let people speculate, but we need you at some point to say, hey, I've seen the light and I'm not going to be a part of this. Would I love it if someone like Jeff Duncan would come out and say that not only will he not do this, but that he would support Joe Biden? I would love it. Do I think he's going to? I don't think he is, right? I would love for him to continue to stay the course, unlike people like Chris Sununu, who last week said he's going to endorse Trump and back Trump. It was just appalling. I would love him to not do that. But my biggest wish is for him to not continue to play ball with no labels. And I think that wish will come true.
Yeah, well said. Hey, Greg, I got a question for you just to add a little bit of color to the Georgia political landscape. Can you give us a sense of what the consultant matrix looks like in Georgia Republican politics and how much overlap there is between, so, Kemp's people and Duncan's people versus sort of in a lot of states, and I don't want to, you know, name any specific names right now, but in a lot of states, there tends to be like one or two, maybe three general consultants who tend to run most of the campaigns. And you have one firm that sort of runs all the top of ticket races. And then you got a B-list firm that runs the ledge races, something like that. Can you give us a sense of what that's like in Georgia and maybe who Duncan is listening to versus who's advising some of the bigger names in Georgia?
Yeah, I don't know if Duncan's listening to any of the political strategists here in Georgia. This is a guy who's always been pretty headstrong anyway. And if you go back to even his stint as lieutenant governor, he had some very public fallings out with his chief of staff at the time, who was advising him. And this is really inside baseball, but when Governor Brian Kemp selected Kelly Loeffler as his appointee to the U.S. Senate, Jeff Duncan immediately endorsed Kelly Loeffler. And his advisor, I reported all this later on, is one of his top advisors, said, hey, you know, you didn't have to immediately do that. You could have gotten a concession. You could have gotten him to, he really needed your endorsement at the time because Jeff was a popular Republican incumbent at the time. You know, you could have gotten a policy win, whatever. Jeff just went all in. And what ended up coming out is that Jeff Duncan has multiple life coaches, and he would often get advice from his life coaches. And again, this is all on the record. I don't know if he still does, but his then chief of staff was just upset that Jeff Duncan was so headstrong sometimes that he wouldn't listen to his political advice and he'd listen to, you know, one of his life coach's advice. So who's not necessarily engrossed in the Republican machinery in Georgia. But in terms of the different consultants and how that sphere works, there are a number of different Republican camps here in Georgia. There's the Governor Kemp machine. There's sort of the older guard, his predecessor, Nathan Deal, his own sort of network that's still existent, that was very closely tied with Johnny Isaacson, the late U.S. Senator. Johnny Isaacson's chief of staff, Chris Carr, is now the Attorney General of Georgia. So there's different political spheres, and then there's the whole MAGA sphere. There's a guy named Billy Kirkland, who's really one of the top operatives in the MAGA world here in Georgia, who's very involved with, also very close allied with Sonny Perdue, who is not only the first Republican governor in Georgia since Reconstruction, but also Trump's agriculture secretary for the entire 4 years. He made it the whole 4 years and is now the chancellor of the higher education system. So there's a lot of different concentric circles that overlap in Georgia, but there's not a clearly ascendant, you know, there's rival camps. And even within the party, you've got this Georgia GOP, which top priority is electing Trump and fighting the legal battles for the election interference case in Fulton County. And you've got Governor Kemp, who started his own rival political network to really focus on those legislative races that he feels the Georgia GOP isn't focusing on. So it's a lot of tattered relationships, but it's a very complicated scene here in Georgia. Whew.
Well, if he's looking for life coaching advice, I hear Marianne Williamson has some time. I don't know what she charges for it, but maybe that's more up his alley. Okay, there is a bloodbath at the RNC, and this is important because it's happening so close to the election. So we've been following this story for a couple of weeks now since news broke that Ronna McDaniel was going to be stepping down as the chair. She's now done that. Trump has pushed for Michael Whatley, who's a close ally, and Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, to become the committee's chair and co-chair. They were unanimously elected to those roles last Friday, and Chris LaCivita, one of Trump's top campaign guys, is coming in to serve as chief of staff. So on Monday, Trump's campaign took over operational control of the RNC, and they started cleaning house. The RNC's new chief operating officer sent an email to some political and data staff saying the leadership was, quote, in the process of evaluating the organization and staff to ensure the building is aligned with its vision. During this process, certain staff are being asked to resign and reapply for a position on the team. The Times is reporting that the email was drafted so hastily that he misspelled his own last name. So far, there have been more than 60 people, including senior staff members, who've been laid off or asked to resign and reapply for their jobs. The New York Times is reporting that it's not clear if they've completed their purge or if more cuts are on the way. Politico and The Times are both reporting that the move is part of a restructuring that's going to merge whole departments of the RNC and the Trump campaign. Politico is reporting that communications, data, and fundraising departments will effectively be one and the same. The New York Times is reporting the RNC's finance and digital teams are being moved to Palm Beach, where the campaign's based, and the party campaign operations are going to be functionally fused into one. Not to be outdone by the National Party, Republicans in Johnson County, Kansas, held a fundraiser last Friday where attendees were punching and kicking a martial arts training dummy fitted with a Joe Biden mask. The mannequin was also wearing a Let's Go Brandon t-shirt. Lucy, so a couple of things stood out to me about this story. First, that there's some things that are very not normal, but there's also some things in here that are quite normal for an election year at the RNC. Once you have a nominee, there is very often a big changing of the guard. There is maybe not quite as severe as this, but there is certainly some restructuring. Once you have a presidential candidate, you have a nominee at the party, it's very normal for the two to work very closely hand in hand and for a lot of efficiencies to sort of, you want to streamline operations as much as you can because they become very, very closely tied. That part is very normal. And I think most of the press have like overblown that part of it. What is not normal is that the candidate's daughter is now chair of the committee and that they're talking about paying legal bills. Given everything we know about the Trump operation, there's a lot of reasons to be concerned about the co-opting of the party committee sort of permanently into another business arm of the Trump empire. So can you help sort of parse the differences between what would this look like in a normal campaign year? What would it look like, Romney, Bush, McCain, the way parties and presidential candidates, party nominee campaigns tend to work together and streamline operations versus what's now happening under the Trump situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that an even one contrast point to think about is what happened in 2016 when Donald Trump became the nominee. And I'm sorry to say that I was a vendor to the RNC at that time and to many Republican presidential candidates in 2016. Well, I'm not sorry to say that. I'm sorry to say that I had the RNC as a client when Donald Trump became the nominee. And I had a meeting at the RNC the day after he became the presumptive nominee. It was in the first week of May. And it was, you walked into the building and it was like everything had changed, right? Because the building knew, and yes, we call it the building, but the building knew that they needed to start playing nice with Donald Trump and his campaign, which they really had not been so much, but that's normal. And that also you have to figure out where to find efficiencies. So this was in the days where a lot of the Trump operations were, in San Antonio, for example, right? So you had huge amounts of the RNC digital team then relocate to Texas to be a part of that. And that's normal. That is normal to find efficiencies. But normally it's additive. So one of the things that the Trump campaign did not have in 2016, for example, is that they had basically no ground game at the point that they became the nominee, at the point that Donald Trump became the nominee. And it was really pretty striking because they were being run by a team that really did not have presidential campaign experience, right? And had sort of like fallen into this. Brad Parscale, right? Like guy who was making golf websites, truly like websites for golf courses, yep. was suddenly like, oh my God, right? And they were trying to figure out how to bring in real pros like Kellyanne Conway and others. But they realized, oh, great. It turns out that the Republican National Committee has spent the last several years building up a great field program. And we're just going to plug into that, right? And we might want to make some tweaks, but we see that this is all very additive, right? Like we're going to embrace the infrastructure they've built. They have, you know, like a door knocking file. They know how to go out and knock doors and talk to voters. And that really was the RNC's infrastructure in 2016 is why Donald Trump won the election. The RNC after 2012, when they had been so embarrassed, the Republican Party was so embarrassed in the Romney days, right? Like it was like, wow, the DNC is way ahead of us. We are nowhere on, you know, like modern campaign infrastructure. They had spent a lot of years really working to build that up. And I was in those conversations. Ron, you were in those conversations, right? There was an awareness. We've got to do something different. So Donald Trump walks in 2016, and he's gifted this incredible asset that the RNC has built. And it's why he won. It is why he won in 2016. And it's not just the data piece. It was, you know, the work that the finance team had done, the work that the digital team had done. It was all of it. The RNC had really put themselves in an incredible position. And so you think about that and you think about that legacy of that work. And of course, the shift culturally in the Republican Party is a big reason that that work does not exist in the form that it exists in now. But now what you're seeing is the slow train that has been coming, and it's like lit on fire and it's going off a cliff. And this is kind of like the realization of that 8 years later, that not only has the RNC not continued to make those investments that won Donald Trump the presidency in 2016, and it's not just at the National Committee, right? Like every state party chair was replaced in very short order. For like something like 80% of the party chairs by 2019 had been replaced by Trump loyalists. But now this is kind of like the crescendo moment where you're talking about doing things like merging departments that are completely unrelated, right? And you're talking about slashing staff. And so that part of it is totally, totally different. I'm thrilled, frankly, because if you are getting kudos from Charlie Kirk, a person who basically was just like a teenage organizer who then has a big kind of like hate mongering machine, and that's the only thing Turning Point USA does. If Turning Point USA is saying that the RNC is doing something right, that's a great sign for people who want to see Joe Biden get reelected. This is just very different. It is very abnormal, and it is not going to end well whatsoever.
I wasn't going to mention Charlie Kirk because he's a discount Ben Shapiro, but I'm here for it.
That's insulting to Ben Shapiro.
Greg, can you talk a little bit about the way the media has been reporting on this and whether, like, I've seen some of these stories, but none of them seem to sort of explain the nuance of what happens at a party committee in an election year once you have presumptive nominees versus, like, you know, like the normal this is the same thing is true on the Democratic side, in that it is certainly now a wing of the Biden campaign, right? That is the purpose of the DNC. And like, look, I'm here to dunk on Trump all day long, and I'm, you know, super happy to do that. But I think it's sort of doing a disservice by not explaining to people, no, there's an aspect of this is quite normal for a presidential campaign. What's not normal is everything that Lucy just laid out and the degree to which this is really going to hurt Donald Trump in the election.
Yeah, you know, I thought it was more important to write about this process in 2016 when I would be covering local, you know, county GOP meetings here in Georgia, precinct meetings even sometimes, where you'd have this big battle between Ted Cruz supporters or even Jeb Bush supporters who were in control of the local infrastructure and who also controlled the delegate nomination process. That, when we saw the Donald Trump supporters come and sort of swamp these meetings, that was a huge story for us. Now it's more rote. I would say, though, the other big part of this that we're watching very closely, not just in for the RNC, but also our local GOP, is the likelihood that those RNC donations would go to pay Donald Trump's legal fees and not to go help door knockers or down ticket candidates. Because just a few moments ago, we had the Georgia GOP chair, Josh McCoon, on our Politically Georgia podcast. And I asked him that question: is your goal with this takeover, do you hope the RNC would help pay the legal fees for other co-defendants down here in Georgia? And he said 100%. So we're going to be watching that, as you know, these folks who are donating, hoping that they're going to pay for, you know, flyers and radio ads and whatever for down ticket Republican candidates. Instead, those donations are going to go to pay really expensive legal bills for people caught up in this racketeering trial in Georgia.
Yeah, that reminds me of another aspect of this we didn't touch on, Lucy, but like the degree to which the National Party in an election year funds all the victory committees in especially in battleground states, and how crucial that financing is for state parties who always struggle to raise money, as you know. Given how much money they are, it seems like they're going to be planning on, you know, paying all of Trump's legal bills, and sort of that's like the number one bucket in the cascade of finances. How are cash-strapped state parties going to, I mean, not my problem, but how are cash-strapped state parties going to, you know, do what they need to do to run victory efforts in the summer? It's just not going to happen.
They're not going to. And actually, you know, my look ahead, which I'll save, relates to other entities that are popping up and trying to make this happen. I think that'll take a lot of different forms. It may take the form of some outside groups focusing only on trying to help Republicans win down ballot. And there are certainly forces in the donor space that aren't interested in a Trump reelect, but are interested in Republican down ballot wins. And that would be especially, funders like the Koch Network, right? Or funders like AOA, you know, other sort of like traditional Republican donor class types who don't like Trump, but do care about what we would consider traditional, you know, Republican policy agendas. Not that this Republican Party is doing much of those. A lot of those entities actually actively don't want Trump to win. And they think that if he does win, then 2026 would be a bloodbath for Republicans, which is cute because it presumes that we would have elections in 2026, which I'm not sure we would. I'm truly.
Yeah, I know.
And maybe we would. Maybe the elections would stop in 2028. I don't know. I would probably have to have left the country by then. But I mean, I'm being a little glib, but I'm also saying things that are real. Not really. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, again, as you're talking about normally the kind of shared work that happens between a party committee and the state parties, that is not going to happen. And that's why the infrastructure at the RNC and the JFC, the Joint Fundraising Committee, work is so important in election years, because the RNC, actually, state parties are kind of like community boosters. Like the role that state parties play is that in the off year and during at other times, they're a social gathering place for precinct committeemen, for volunteers. Like they go to the state party, they have Lincoln Day dinners. Like, and that, by the way, is actually traditionally the kind of work of the co-chair of the RNC to kind of help with that. That's what Lara Trump is supposed to be doing. And so ultimately, when campaign season kicks into high gear, that's when the RNC basically blows into town and is like, we're here to get serious, right? Like, let's get you trained on these tools. Let's get you door knocking. Like, let's get the paid media going. And Michael Whatley, the new chair, is very, very seasoned. But the problem is he's probably very much in kind of like fur-lined handcuffs at the RNC right now, because Lara Trump, who's co-chair, is being elevated in a way that is quite abnormal for a co-chair, right? I bet most people couldn't tell us who the co-chair was under Ronna McDaniel, right? It is unusual for a co-chair to have this kind of public face. And now the co-chair is out saying that what they're going to use the money on is legal bills. So they're going to be nowhere on that infrastructure. And what's really bad about that is that that means that the only kind of candidates who are going to get traction are extremist candidates who just have loud megaphones, right? It's not going to be infrastructure that then elevates moderate Republicans that we might want to see sort of build toward the future of Jeff Duncan's GOP 2.0. It's going to be the Carrie Lakes of the world, the Herschel Walkers of the world, the crazies.
Okay, now that we are caught up on some of the biggest stories this week, let's find out what else our panel is paying attention to. What do you got, Greg?
Well, I'm watching closely the Israel-Hamas war and the impact that it has on the electorate, of course. Even in a state like Georgia, where the Muslim population is relatively small, a few thousand left the ballot blank on Tuesday's primary. Organizers say, look, we expect to be back in the Biden camp in November. We just want to change of course. And then just before we came on the show today, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, made news when he just ripped apart Benjamin Netanyahu and called him a major obstacle to peace in the Middle East, called for new leadership in Israel. I think the pressure is going to be even mounting even more.
Yeah, indeed. Lucy, what'd you bring?
Well, I have to admit that Georgia's on my mind as well. and that is because of the news this week that Ralph Reed, who was the man who brought us the Christian Coalition way back when, announced that his group, the Faith and Freedom Coalition, is going to spend upwards of $60 million in turnout in 2024, in particular, evangelical turnout. And this is one of those forces that I think in the absence of critical RNC infrastructure, it is going to become such a driving force around the turnout machine. And it's really, I mean, Faith and Freedom is a hardcore evangelical network. So they're going to spend more than $60 million on voter registration of evangelical voters, texting, phone banking, door knocking, and they expect to spend many millions more than they spent in 2020. They're going to try to hand out 30 million pieces of literature in 125,000 churches, especially in battleground states. So of course, in Ralph Reed's home state of Georgia and otherwise. And I think that this is really significant, and I wanted it to be on Politicology listeners' radar in particular, because of all the illuminating episodes that you've done with folks like Matthew Taylor or John Ward, and you know, in the backdrop of new books that are out in the last few months, like Tim Alberta's book, I think it's really going to see a much stronger link between the evangelical lobby and the RNC turnout machine this year. And it's one of those things where I think a lot of people make the assumption that it's dying out, or because of issues on the ballot like choice, that its power or influence is limited. But I actually think that we will see that the evangelical lobby is going to be a very powerful one in 2024. And that's going to really shift the way that Republicans in close elections are talking, because they're going to feel like they need to go get those evangelical voters out. So keep an eye on that.
Huge, huge, huge. It's a really good one.
By the way, we're on that theme. Ralph Reed ran for lieutenant governor in Georgia about 15 years ago. So, you know, from Ralph Reed to Jeff Duncan. Reed didn't win, of course, but here we go.
So Ken Buck is playing some savage chess to help anyone who's not named Lauren Boebert. So last year, Buck announced that he wouldn't run for re-election in the Colorado 4th Congressional District. So Lauren Boebert decided to run for the 4th seat instead of in her current district, because it's more favorable for a Republican. This week, Buck announced that he's going to leave Congress next week, which will then trigger a special election to replace him until the end of the term. It will also drop the Republican majority to 2 votes. Since Boebert is currently a member of Congress, she'd have to vacate her seat to run in the special election, and would have given the Republicans a 1-seat majority until that election. So Boebert announced on Wednesday that she's going to forgo the special election, finish her term representing Colorado 3rd, and to add another wrinkle here, the special election for the remainder of Buck's term is going to coincide with the primary election for the full term. So if she's going to stay in Congress, Boebert is going to need to convince voters who are pulling the lever for a different person in the special election to also vote for her in the primary at the same time. So good luck, Lauren Boebert.
It's such a weird thing, too, because in Colorado, in the way that a special election works, is that a vacancy committee basically for both parties get to pick the nominee. So there's functionally like no primary. And I think that the part of the reason that Lauren Boebert said, for a lot of reasons, that she wouldn't play in the special is that she knows that she's really, really unpopular among Republicans in that district, and that that committee of a few dozen party leaders or a handful of party leaders who will pick who the Republican nominee is going into that special that occurs on the same day. I think it's June 25th. It's June, right?
Mm-hmm. It's June. Yeah, it's June.
That occurs on the same day as that primary, that she is going to be nowhere in that and probably would not be chosen anyway. So it's, I think it's curtains on Lauren Boebert's time in Congress after November. Couldn't have happened to a nicer gal.
All right. Before we head over to Politicology Plus, where we're going to talk about to ban or not to ban. Is it even a ban? I don't know. Nancy Pelosi doesn't want you to think so. TikTok. Lucy, where can everybody find you on the internet these days?
I'm on Twitter at Lucy M. Caldwell.
We don't say X around here. Greg, go ahead.
I can still call it Twitter too, but I'm there on Bluestein, and I guess I'm on Instagram too as Greg Bluestein, Bluestein.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.